guest today on this episode of Newton Talks is historian of medicine and psychiatry, Dr. Jennifer Wallace. She's the author of Investigating the Body in the Victorian Asylum, Doctors, Patients and Practices, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Jennifer has also written extensively on film and has a particular interest in horror and cult cinema. And she joins me today to talk about how these two research strands have combined in a focus on the representation of the asylum in film, with a particular focus on the horror genre.
Is there an overall history or trajectory of the depiction of asylums on screen in horror films?
That is a very, very interesting question. So I think there are different periods to this, to me anyway. I mean, other people might disagree, but I think in the early years of the 20th century, you get the rather gothic depictions of the asylum in film. So you have the things that are very much kind of in the Grand Guignol tradition of that kind of theatrical, over-the-top adaptation of stage plays like The Lunatics. And you've also got things like Dr. Caligari, where, you know, it's very stylized, and there's the madness of the asylum in it are kind of more aesthetically explored than anything else, I guess, where it's not so much about exploring the reasons behind somebody's behavior or the way that madness is understood in society, but it's just more about using that for its aesthetic or its sensational value. And then I think when you get towards the middle of the century, you get a change where there's a bit more interest in the social aspects and the social political kind of links between the asylum and society. So in the 1940s, for instance, you get a number of exposés of asylums and the treatment within them, and often the bad conditions, because these are, a lot of them anyway, and particularly in America, were still Victorian buildings. So they're quite outdated, they're overcrowded, particularly around the time of the Second World War, they're also understaffed and struggling a little bit. And so you get films like The Snake Pit, which I guess is probably the supreme example of the asylum film. And these were really concerned with showing asylums as being quite, again, quite gothic places, but they're more interested in the systemic injustice or the systemic abuses within them, and the fact that they are chronically underfunded institutions and problematic in that way. And then I think if you go into the 60s are really pivotal, because you get the rise of what we call the anti-psychiatry movement. So you've got people like Ronnie Lang, David Cooper, and you've got books coming out by people like Thomas Satz, who are saying that basically madness is manufactured, and psychiatry as a discipline needs to be overhauled. And so you get things like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is not horror, but is, you know, there are horrific elements in it, which is very much an indictment of the asylum, but maybe a bit more coming at it from an angle where it's saying this is now an outdated institution for the second half of the 20th century. And then I think the period that I'm most interested in is the 70s, and particularly the way that asylums and the mad, to use a very problematic but also historically interesting term, people are depicted as being dangerous very much. And I think that's linked to the fact that the asylums themselves were in the process of being closed down. People were starting to talk about getting rid of them as a cost-cutting exercise, but there's also the ideological aspect of anti-psychiatry, that these are not the way you should deal with mental illness anymore. And so those are quite interesting in that they position people as being kind of figures of fear. So patients are really stigmatized in those. But then finally, I think now where we are is also equally interesting, because you've got films that look at the asylum instead of the patient as being the horrific aspect or the thing that should instill fear in the viewer. So American Horror Story obviously is kind of, the big thing at the moment. But before that, there's a whole number of horror films that use abandoned asylums as their key scene and their key site. And I think those are really interesting because they often suggest that the asylum itself is pathological and not the patients within it. So that's a long answer to that question.
No, that's really good. I want to talk a little bit about those films, or I want you to talk a little bit about those films in a little while. But I'm just going to ask a couple of questions now. And firstly, and this might seem like a really obvious answer, but who went in to asylums? Who was admitted? So was it people with genuine, what we now know as mental health or mental conditions, but also did it hoover up a lot of people who had conditions that we wouldn't treat in that way now?
So in the Victorian asylums, you've got a huge number of people in some of them. These were absolutely massive, really vast institutions where you've got 1,000 beds in some of them. So it's a large patient population. It's also very diverse. So they were, I think one of the preconceptions about Victorian asylums is that they targeted people like unwed mothers or women, and that they were just generally hoovering up people who were somehow socially inadequate in some way. And certainly there was some truth in that, but they were also treating people who were genuinely very ill. So if you look at the lists of admissions for 19th century asylums, you'll often see things mentioned like mania, depression. You see quite a lot of cases of what we would now call postpartum depression, which was linked at the time actually to women's pregnancies and childbirth. The big thing that I studied particularly was called general paralysis of the insane, which we now generally understand to be neurosyphilis. So if syphilis isn't treated, it develops into this full-blown neurological condition. And that took up quite a lot of space in late 19th century asylums in particular. And then when you come into the first half of the 20th century, you see more interesting thing in kind of delineating things much more specifically and classifying things into new systems. So the big things in the early years of the 20th century are schizophrenia as a diagnosis. So that starts to be more clearly delineated or brought out. And you've also, of course, got World War One. So you've got things like shell shock, which is often catered to in specialist asylums, but would also have affected the intake of just general asylums as well. So it's a really mixed bunch.
I'm a big fan of Call the Midwife, right? And I was currently reading the book, and there's a lot of talk in that about this fear of hospitals that still existed in the 1960s. And I wonder whether there's a correlation between the hospital, the asylum, and workhouses that was happening around the time of the late the Victorian era and into the early part of the 20th century. And maybe it's something to do with, I don't know whether it links back to that idea of the aesthetic exploration of the asylum in these early films, in that there's something about the way those buildings are constructed that is particularly either eerie or particularly gothic. And as you say, in some of the later films, actually feeds into creating the madness or creating the horror and being a source of the horror rather than the patient.
Yeah, there's mentioning your mention of workhouse, there is absolutely a trajectory there. So the 19th century apparatus, the state apparatus, if you like, at first was very much based around workhouses as the place where, you know, most poorer people who were in some kind of trouble would end up. And that could include people with mental illness, but they were increasingly unwilling to have disruptive people in the workhouse. And so from the mid 19th century, you get a much greater drive by the state to actually force each county in Britain to build an asylum for its pauper lunatics, as they were called at the time. And so you have this definite crossover between the workhouse and healthcare sites. The other interesting one, which might be going slightly off topic, is that when you have in the mid 19th century, there's the beginnings of a kind of Victorian anti-vaccination movement, and a lot of some of the resistance to vaccination amongst that group was based around the fact that vaccination was seen as very stigmatizing because it was workhouses or buildings that were adjacent to workhouses, because they were the biggest public buildings you had around, that were used as vaccination centers. And so it seems quite stigmatizing to be going to a workhouse or in the vicinity of one to get healthcare. So they're definitely kind of problematic.
So what is the relationship then in some of these films? Are you talking about films from the 1970s? Now, I'm guessing some of these, because I know you've got a love of horror films and other genre films like that. So are you talking about principally things like the Amicus productions of the 1970s? Tales That Witness Madness, there's a film called Asylum. Is The House That Dripped Blood, is that in an asylum as well, but it deals with mental illness? What is it about those films that first attracted you? And is there an issue there, just how this crosses over with your genuine understanding of the history of these places? What's the tension between those two things?
Yeah, I know what you mean. And it is really interesting to, as a historian of psychiatry, to also be kind of writing about these films in a very different context as well. And weirdly, I tend to be able to separate them quite easily, although I am that really irritating person who, if you're watching a horror film with me and it's set in an asylum, I will say, you know, that's a historical inaccuracy. They weren't using that treatment at that time. But yeah, I think I grew up kind of watching Hammer Horror and Amicus. And so there is weirdly, there's an element of comfort viewing in those films for me, in that, you know, that nice cozy kind of Hammer horror thing. But then doing the history of psychiatry and rewatching them later, you see them in a very different light. And I guess what strikes me about those in particular, and maybe Tales That Witness Madness in particular, which is not a very good film, but I will say it's entertaining. That is, it makes me think of that old Prince by William Hogarth, which is the really famous one called The Rake's Progress. And in it, the main character ends up in Bedlam Asylum. And all of the people around him are very stock asylum characters. You know, you've got like the person who thinks they're Napoleon and the person who's obsessed with the stars and astrology or something like that. And those kind of films, those Amicus films, really did that as well. They had these people who were mad because they've become obsessed with one thing or one object or one particular kind of event had pushed them over the edge. And this was what they obsessed over for the rest of their life in the asylum.
Yeah, that tells the witness madness, is it? Yeah, from what I recall, there's a man who's obsessed with a tree. And yeah. A kid who's obsessed with a toy tiger or something like that. It's like when they're kept in the asylum at the end, that's the thing they're still obsessed with. That's the thing that they're
the absolute worst segment of any portmanteau of horror is in Tales That Witness Madness. And it's not the tree to me, it's the other one that's in the middle where there's an antique shop and there's a man with a penny farthing and a very comical picture on the wall of an old Victorian gentleman, and he becomes possessed by this penny farthing. It's terrible.
In those films as well, I don't know if it's the, I mean, I've seen all those films, but not for a while. In all those films, it always seems to be the twist at the end is always that the psychiatrist showing you around is really the mad one or what it is. There's always the person who's showing it around is an inmate of the asylum. That's the twist in all of them. And right up until like Shutter Island and stuff like that, I think it's the same twist in that. It's always the same twist. Is there something in that about what horror films, who they ask us to identify with? On the one hand, it's making these mental patients, again, I'm using that term in you know, the way that it's used in those films, the mental patients and the mad patients as being abject. But on the other hand, there's an element where the horror films ask us to sympathise with these people and see them in a different way, and maybe they're not quite as regressive in that regard. Am I wrong or right in that interpretation?
No, I think there's definitely an element of truth in that. And if you think about psychiatry historically as a discipline, it's often been quite a maligned discipline. So if you look at the late 19th century, a lot of psychiatrists or alienists, as they might have been called at the time, They were really pushing to demonstrate that they had knowledge and skills that were relevant to society, because they were seen as very much not part of medicine, and they fought for a long time to be seen as a genuine and a proper area and a proper specialism. And so there's always been this kind of element, I think, of psychiatrists being slightly stigmatized or figures of fun in some way. And so, yeah, I think there's definitely something in that, as you say. There's a lot of those films capitalize on this reveal, which we've now ruined for everybody, which, you know, that it's really the psychiatrist who's mad, you know, or as mad as his patients. And the point is that you cannot tell the difference. You know, in Asylum, Robert Powell's character, who's being asked to come in and figure out who, you know, who's really mad and who isn't, he can't tell. And he can't tell that the psychiatrist who's in charge of the place himself has gone mad. And so there's a really, I think there's something in there that's actually quite an interesting and profound point about an anxiety about not being able to spot who is mad and who is dangerous. And I don't think that's a coincidence that that happens in those films around that time of the 70s, when you've got asylums closing and you've got deinstitutionalization in full swing and the shift to care in the community. Where, if you look at the tabloids at this time, you just see this everywhere, that people have this genuine fear that you are going to be surrounded by the inmates of the asylum who have escaped, and you are going to be in danger because you won't be able to spot them.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So it's this idea, isn't it, that what was once abject is now amongst us, it once was hidden away, and it's no longer hidden away and amongst us. And does that then feed in, do you think, then to your other point, the later films set in asylums tends to be about people going back into these abandoned places?
Yeah. And I think lots of historians recently have written about this as well. There's a fantastic book by Barbara Taylor called The Last Asylum. And she's a historian with experience of psychiatric hospitals as well. And so she talks at the end of her book about the fact that, you know, we see asylums as these kind of gothic institutions that are quite frightening. But for many patients, and particularly long stay patients who might have been there 10, 20 years sometimes, these were their homes, and they were places where they had a community and they had a family of sorts. And so when they closed, you know, community care sounded brilliant in theory, but didn't necessarily work that way in practice. And actually a lot of the infrastructure wasn't there. People didn't have the support that they should have had. And so there were instances of many patients kind of gravitating back to these sites because this was the place where they had felt kind of reasonably safe and reasonably looked after. And so there is certainly something there about the asylum being like a memory of a place of refuge for some people, but then on the other side it's seen as this symbol of something very outdated. And I can't help but think that that is partly because there were many of them Victorian buildings. And so when Enoch Powell in 1961, he's very certain in his so-called water tower speech about, you know, the fact that these institutions are now completely outdated, they're of no use to psychiatric care anymore. Of course, underlying all this, he actually wanted to save quite a bit of money. But he evokes, you know, like the gothic image of these places that are like these looming majestic buildings with water towers on top of them. And so there's something slightly incongruous, I guess, that these buildings did not project the image of being like modern psychiatric facilities.
You've kind of like coined a term of for these later films that go into into the 80s and the 90s and the noughties, centered around narratives of people going into abandoned asylums to spend the night or whatever it might be. House on Haunted Hill, I think, is one of them. And a film that you particularly like called Session 9. And you call these urbex movies.
Yeah, so I think they really capitalise on that interest, and I think a growing interest in urban exploration, or urbex as the explorers refer to it, which has very much centred around asylums, I think. Maybe not so much now, because so many of them have actually either been demolished, particularly in Britain, or they've been converted, ironically, into luxury gated apartment complexes, which I think is an entire article in itself, that places that people once didn't want to be in are now kind of, you know, hugely expensive flats that you can live in and be waited on. Films like House on Haunted Hill is interesting because, of course, it's nothing like the original. It was not an asylum in the original, and that is an additional aspect to the plot. And the horror in that one is very much the building itself, which doesn't so much hold like the ghosts of patients, but the spirits of sinister doctors and nurses who have done terrible things to the patients in the past. And so in those films, I think it's quite interesting that the asylum building, and it is important that they are very decrepit, kind of grand, dark, shambling buildings with curtains fluttering and old wheelchairs in the corridors and things. The buildings themselves come to feed upon or to pursue the people who go into them, who are either, you know, urban explorers or buildings teams or groups of teenagers who are somewhere where they shouldn't be.
Yeah, I'm going off at a tangent here, so I do want to get back onto that. But that when you mentioned about the doctors, I think the mad doctor in House on Haunted Hill is played by Jeffrey Combs, who's also obviously in Reanimator. And that's got that history of that kind of Frankenstein tradition. So I suppose there's also a literary and filmic tradition of the doctors not being trusted as well, and just science not being trusted in general, right? That maybe crossovers with these asylum films at some point as well.
Definitely. And I think the asylum in particular has got so much potential, hasn't it, in horror to introduce like equipment or procedures that are frightening, whether or not they were really used. So, you know, setting aside the fact that ECT would not have been used in the 1850s, as some TV shows or films seem to think, you know, these are things that were at the time actually seen in a very positive light, that, you know, things like ECT, things like coma therapy, which was a thing in the early 20th century, and even things like lobotomy.
What was coma therapy? Sorry to interrupt you, Jennifer.
It was insulin coma therapy, was basically using insulin to place patients into an artificial coma. And so the idea was, they seemed to have got this idea that, you know, there was like a balance between schizophrenia and something. I can't remember. But the idea was, you know, you went to sleep for a bit and woke up, but it sounded horrible.
Yeah, I think what you just mentioned there before the coma therapy bit, which obviously just does sound terrible, was there's an element, isn't there, with all filmmaking, where you've got the expediency and the inspiration for ideas and wanting to sell a concept clashing constantly with the social reality of making films that are about human beings. So also one thing you get with, if you can make a film in an abandoned building, is you've got your location sorted, right? And these films are typically low budget, and therefore it's one location, you can make the entire film there. You don't have it, so you've got that kind of a logistical factor, you know, yeah, that has to then combine with the social reality of making a film in what was once this space which caused or created or housed a lot of misery. I think that's a tension that horror films are always struggling with, I think, you know, because it's oftentimes that, you know, like, I had a student once who was saying in a presentation, which is a fair enough thing to say, that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a really insensitive portrayal of mental health. And I guess it is if you look at it from that perspective. But we also want to make a film about somebody being chased with a chainsaw, right? Right. And so there's an element where we have to tell a story here. And I think those things are always clashing with each other.
I think that's really true. And again, I think this is where people hate me being a historian of psychiatry and watching films with them sometimes, because I get very cross when people talk about Fight Club being about dissociative identity disorder, because personally, I'm pretty sure it isn't. The book never came across as that to me. When the film came out, that was not how it was read. But it's very easy to impose psychiatric readings on films, I think. even when there isn't one, which is interesting in itself. And perhaps there's something about like the modern condition of wanting to diagnose everything. So yeah, that's one of my bugbears.
Yeah, I think it tells us a lot about film analysis and film studies as well, and the way that's going as well. Tell us something then about this film Session 9, because you've earmarked this as a particularly interesting film, and it's not one that I'd even heard of before. And doing my research on it, it turns out a lot of people hadn't either. And it seems like one of those almost forgotten films that came under the radar that didn't really make as that much of a splash. Tell us why you like this film, Session 9.
I'm a big fan of this film, and partly because it is set in a genuine old asylum in America. So it's set in the Danvers Asylum, which is now being demolished, sadly. It was actually one of the famous Kirkbride asylums, which had a very distinctive layout. So if you looked at them from the top downwards, they looked almost like a bat with the wings going outwards. So they were a very like a model institution of the mid-19th century in America. So they really were, you know, incredible buildings and incredible pieces of architecture. And you can still see that when you watch the film. And so they capitalize on that in Session 9. You watch it and you think, wow, what an amazing set. There's paint peeling off the walls. There's murals on the walls. There are old kind of hydropathic equipment and baths in the basements. And all of this apparently was still there. And based on my own knowledge of urban exploration, that seems very likely, as does the fact that apparently in the basement, there were still patient records from Danvers left in the asylum after its closure. And this is actually quite common if you speak to urban explorers in this country who have been into decommissioned asylums here. They often found that places had just been left and not cleared out properly. And so you do find patient records in some of these places. And if you listen to some of the interviews with the Session 9 cast, they talk about wandering around this place and kind of soaking up the atmosphere of it and actually going and reading these old case files in their break and things. So they really interact with the building. And one of the threads in the film is that they are there as a building crew on a renovation. So again, it fits perfectly. But they're there partly to remove asbestos from the building, which would have been in many of these buildings and probably was in Danvers as well. And so there's a weird kind of, you know, crossover between reality and fiction in Session 9 for the actors. And I think I'd love to speak to some of them in more detail about the experience of filming that, because I think it's so interesting. But I also think Session 9 is quite a sympathetic film in the way that, so it has its moments of horror sensation. So you've got, you know, somebody who ends up with a lobotomy ice pick through the eye. You've got somebody running down the dark tunnels underneath the asylum in the basement. But it's actually quite sensitive as well in some ways. And you do see this portrayal of people kind of being slowly consumed by their own demons. And it's not very explicit, you know, is this the asylum? Or is this them and the asylum brings out something in them? Are people coming back to the asylum because it's a place where they have an affinity? And so it's a really, really interesting film on lots and lots of levels for me, I think.
What was the origins of making this film? Was it a case of just pure expediency, or is there a more creative or artistic reason for setting it in Danvers?
So apparently the director, Brad Anderson, was driving past the old Danvers Asylum and saw it and thought, oh, wow, that needs to be a film set, which it did. And I think it's actually, from a historian's point of view as well, I think it's brilliant that it's actually documented in that state as well and in such detail, because we've got a lot of urban exploration photographs and things of Danvers before it was demolished. But these are places that, as I think I've suggested before, that are seen as shameful in some way, or as a part of the psychiatric past that we don't want to deal with, or that have memories for us that we don't like. And they kind of clash with our own sensibilities of the medical profession being very forward thinking and very you know, progressive, and so these places are not celebrated or preserved often. And so I think there's something quite important about that in what Anderson does with Session 9, that he documents this building and the possible experiences within it quite artistically and sensitively.
That's really interesting what you just said there about the way we viewed the medical profession in the past as something negative in comparison to the way we view the medical profession now, whereas it's seen as something almost entirely positive and entirely progressive and almost sacrosanct. There's a real, I hadn't thought about it before, there's a real, again, a clash between those two depictions. I think almost as if you're thinking about a completely another world when we think about the medical profession from the Victorian era to when it died out.
And I think especially with psychiatry, that's especially marked. So whenever I give public talks or I teach and you introduce the idea of the asylum, people generally have a preconception of what they think the asylum did and what it was like. And actually the reality was incredibly nuanced. There were negative experiences in it, but there were also very positive experiences in it. We seem to have this inability when it comes to the asylum to appreciate it on its own terms, in its own context. And that at the time, many of the treatments that it was doing were based on, you know, common sense understandings of how the brain worked with the body and things. You know, the reason that there are so many physical treatments like ECT in the first half of the 20th century is that people were investigating these links between body and mind, and that they were actually becoming quite desperate to solve, as it were, the problem of very chronic mental illness, because you had these asylums absolutely filling up with cases that were not getting any better. And so there was a drive to actually uncover what it was that made people sick and how to get them better again. Whereas I think now, when we look back at those physical treatments, and especially things like lobotomy, they tend to be presented as just torture almost, or willfully barbaric treatment. And it's important, I think, when you're watching horror like that, that, you know, it is important to know actually the reality of those stories behind it, because otherwise, you know, you are getting a bit of a very, what we would call Whiggish as historians, a very kind of Whiggish and not progressive view of history. This idea that we all progress forwards and that it's just an inevitable, like, going forward. There is no failure, you know, we are inevitably better than people 100 years ago, when actually you think, I'm sure that people will look back at some medical interventions we've done and think, you know, that was very wrong.
You also have done a bit of research into what, into the place of cinema within these asylums back 100 years ago. And you wrote a paper on the West Riding Asylum in the 1920s and how they used film and cinema to entertain the patients. Can you tell us something about that?
So this was a brilliant find. So it was one of those classic, I was mid-PhD in the West Riding Archives because I was doing a case study of that asylum for my PhD and unconnected to cinema, and found this record, which was full of all the details about this cinema that they put together in the 1920s. So it wasn't a permanent cinema. They hadn't got an actual viewing room, although most asylums would have a theatre and a stage that they would use for these kind of things, including putting on their own plays and things like that. And they had been in touch. They had all the correspondence in the archives with various film lending companies. So they were borrowing I think they bought some equipment in the end that they actually installed in the asylum. So they had some projection equipment, which they'd gone into a lot of detail about what they should buy. And then they hired the films from these traveling companies who would, you know, lend you something for a month, I guess. And then you could, so it's a bit like a lending library of films. And so I found all the list of what had been watched in this asylum in the 1920s. So it was a really interesting glimpse into, you know, what the patients were watching, but also perhaps what was intended when they were putting on these film screenings. So obviously there's an element of entertainment there. And I think, again, kind of clashes with this stereotypical idea we have of old asylums being like these places of doom and gloom and nothing good ever happens, that people are just left there to their own devices. But actually, you know, right from the 19th century, there is a drive at many asylums to provide entertainment for patients, and not just to, you know, improve the quality of life within the institution, but to perhaps school them almost into developing their social skills for going back out into the world. So something like a film screening, you would interact with other people, you would have to behave in a certain way at the screening. And so it has that value in terms of its social skill set. But they also perhaps used the cinema, and perhaps this wasn't intentional when it was introduced, but it became a useful thing later, that it could be a reward and a punishment as well. So, you know, if you misbehave today, you won't be going to the film screening later.
Is there any idea of the programming? Is there any idea if it was a censorship of the programming? Was it curated in any way, or was it whatever they could get their hands on?
I think it was very much whatever they could get, and I'm not sure how much choice you actually had. I didn't get the impression from the correspondence that they were sent a catalogue, for instance, and picked what they wanted. But there was one letter where it seemed to me that something had been sent that was seen as not quite suitable, because there was a rather grovelling letter from the film lending company that apologised for them not liking Fangs of the Wolf, which doesn't sound like a comedy, but maybe it was, and saying that they were very sorry, they would never send anything like this again. And the West Riding Asylum actually kind of ran into trouble because it ran out of suitable films, it seemed, to show the patients, because there's letters from another film company that says, we have nothing else we can send you. You've had all the comedies that we have. And so they seemed to generally be focusing on comedies. So, you know, quite often American, like slapstick type things, shorts. So they were watching a lot of those.
That's interesting, especially in terms of what was happening outside of the asylum in relation to censorship and the cinema and the regulation of the cinema buildings based around kind of health and safety, and also the thought of what showing, slapstick comedies that were anti the police or whatever, and the potential for riling people up socially and stuff like that. It's interesting that not applied inside the asylum.
Yeah, I was quite interested in that actually there is no real moral panic, as it were, about what these patients are watching in that period. That seems to be, you know, the concern of the 50s, that, you know, everybody's going to be corrupted by horror comics and later video nasties. It doesn't really have a counterpart in the period that I was looking at. Maybe the closest that you get in the 19th century is the Penny Dreadful novels, which were often highlighted as being problematic. But they're actually, when you look through the contemporary psychiatric journals, there's very little about things like film or literature having a really genuinely malign influence on people.
I don't know if you know the answer to this. So what was thought of as, was alcohol, for example, thought was having a malign influence that led to people being institutionalised? Was that a thing?
So that could be and has been a whole paper in itself as well. So alcohol, interestingly, somebody has written a paper about this, and shamefully I can't remember the historian's name, but they actually, often in the 19th century, beer was part of the asylum dietary, although it wouldn't be very strong, as happened with that kind of, with beer at that time, that was often drunk with meals because it was safer than drinking water. But there is a debate about that later in the century, kind of coming towards the turn of the century, about whether it's appropriate to be serving alcohol in asylums at meal times. Although it was also used medicinally as well. So the old medicinal brandy thing, you know, that happened. Champagne as well, medicinal champagne, which I quite like the idea of. That was introduced at several places, but would be like an ad hoc basis In the same way that some clinicians still do now, you know, that, you know, for a patient to maybe just relax or have something nice, you might prescribe them to just have a drink on the ward one evening. I've spoken to clinicians who are very happy to do that. Alcohol is interesting in the 19th century context because it's really connected to general paralysis, which was neurosyphilis. It's often implicated in that when you read contemporary doctors' accounts. Of course, it didn't cause neurosyphilis, but there was a melding of the behaviours that seemed to be present in those patients, like alcohol use, excessive sexuality. You know, those kind of things were melded together. So it was a very like morally inflected disease. And you also see alcohol implicated in degeneration theory of the 19th century, which, you know, stemmed from this idea that if there's evolution, then a converse process could also exist. And modern life doesn't agree with some people. Some people are not set up or are not strong enough to deal with modernity, and so they will regress. And alcohol was mentioned as being one of the things that can be part of that journey. And so famously, there was this idea that degeneration got worse with each generation. So you might have an alcoholic and then their child would be severely mentally impaired, and then their child would be just completely unable to cope with life.
So I want to wrap this up now. So I've got a question, and maybe this is, again, a really stupid question. When did the word asylum start to fade out? When was that not used in relation to these places?
So that starts to disappear in the early 20th century. So in the 1930s, there's more of a concerted effort to call these mental hospitals instead of asylums, which, I mean, is interesting because now to us, mental hospital also sounds very stigmatized and problematic as well. So the terminology constantly shifts. And so asylum, interestingly, has not been part of our kind of, you know, everyday vocabulary for a long time. But I think, so it's interesting that it gets used so often in these horror films of recent years, you know, even when these places were not being called asylums at the time, they were called like psychiatric institutes or clinics or something. But there's also a case, I think, to be made for using that terminology in its original kind of positive sense as well. You know, the idea of having an asylum that is a place of sanctuary, which was, you know, the original intended meaning. And there's been a lot of movement recently amongst service user groups and mad pride groups who talk about, you know, reclaiming a lot of this language, like madness and asylum, and actually, you know, trying to unstigmatize it, as it were, which I think is really interesting.
Jennifer, thanks very much for that. That was really great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Dr. Jennifer Wallace for joining me today. I've put links in the description to some of her publications. And I want to say thanks to you for listening. Newton Talks will return.